Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. And today, we're going to talk about something a little different. You know, when Adam and I wrote the book Prosper, we have a couple of chapters in there. One is on emotional and spiritual resilience, one of the chapters I consider to be one of the most important ones that's in there. And part of the reason I think it's so important is that if you have emotional resilience, you can make it through almost anything. But if you lack emotional resilience, even if you are rich in all the other seven forms of capital, you might still fall apart and find yourself having a hard time dealing with what is. And it's not just some possible future I'm talking about. I mean, look, we know that the world is in crisis. We know we face predicaments. We know that there's an ecological crisis out there that's extraordinary. We know that there's an economic crisis that's brewing, a political crisis. Whatever lens we want to look at, we see that there are extraordinary predicaments and crises out there. But I'm going to submit to you that each of these is just a symptom. What's really happening is we're having an existential crisis as a species because our main narrative doesn't work anymore. Our main narrative is out of tune with reality. We have overpopulation. We have farmers who are farming in a way that depletes soil. We have money printing that really only exacerbates an already too large wealth gap, the largest in all of history. We have all of these things going on, but they're really happening for the same reason, which is that people are just being people again. Only this time, the whole world is involved. So it really puts a different spin on it this time, which means that personal development and spiritual growth is really one of the most important things you could undertake. In fact, it's been one of the most important things that I've undertaken in my life in the past several years. So I wanted to begin to share that with you. And to help us get there today is an extraordinary individual, a woman named Teal Swan, who is an author. She's increasingly internationally famous as a spiritualist, a spiritual catalyst, as she describes herself. She's an amazing presenter. I saw her in New York with my wife and daughter some months back, and she is just absolutely out there helping to illuminate the inner world for an increasing number of people, and does incredible work. You can check her out on YouTube. She's got a great blog and all of that. So with that, I would like to welcome Teal to the program. Teal, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. That was just totally makes sense to me why you would be talking to me, seeing as how I'm pretty much the queen of the existential crisis. So,
well, I love it. Well, you're talking to somebody who's I'm a scientist by training and got an MBA. I went into this very hyper-rational head world. And when I was younger, I knew a lot. I don't know as much anymore. I'm much more open to the idea that there's a sacred experience here to be had in this life, mm-hmm. and that it's not about accumulating things or dominating or all the things that seem to be, I would say my culture is very much fascinated with at this point in time. But from my perspective, increasingly, I'm talking with people who are managing huge amounts of money to housewives managing small budgets. And increasingly, I'm finding people understanding that something seems really wrong. Like something's really out of alignment here. You know, we're told that the economy's doing okay and this and that, but people are feeling things are not right. And I'm wondering from your spiritual perspective, what is going on here? Are they actually tuning into something that's realistic, or are they what is happening to what I perceive as a real crisis in people's confidence in the story today?
Well, I think that people don't give themselves enough credit for just how, let's say, sensitive they are to the general energies around them. You don't even have to be a scientist and understand the process, really, to know that when you take a person and put them in a room, they instantly get a feeling about that room they're in. So the first thing we have to understand is that we're tied into the collective conscious of all of us on planet Earth. And so the reality is the story beyond what we're being told in the media is that we're not doing well. Like the Earth is not doing well right now. And economically, I am absolutely surprised that we have managed to make it work. And I feel a lot of this is that the people in the general public have been kept dumb to a lot of the stuff that people who are in the higher positions in society are trying to fix and have been for a while but don't know how. Mm-hmm. It's the reason, if you want to know the truth, for many of the wars that have been started recently is because they're trying to maintain something that they cannot maintain. So what we're tapping into is the fact that we are headed towards a massive collapse, an absolute 100% massive collapse. And it's real difficult for somebody in my position to help people to feel okay with the collapse, because we're not in a position where we're going to be able to pull out of this one, because we invested so heavily in systems that had no sustainability. The real issue that we had is that capitalism ran triumphant. Now, there's nothing inherently negative with capitalism. I mean, I would consider myself a genuine capitalist. It's someone that makes the most out of whatever they're given. But the difference between straight capitalism, which has got a lot of ignorance in it, and what we would call conscious capitalism, is the conscious capitalist knows that it depends upon the people at the very bottom. So we've gotten ourselves into a system where essentially it screws all the people on the bottom to benefit the people on the top. That's not a sustainable system long term. It will never work. So what we're experiencing right now is that bottom is essentially corroding out from under us. So a good example, let's say a more practical example of that is you've got the pharmaceutical industry. For example, they're the kind of industries who, to begin with, they may have started for people's health. But now they saw that it was possible to make money off of people being ill, or to make money off of people being in jail, or to make money off of fill in the blank. And so because we've got that type of an attitude now, there's no way that you can actually make that work long term. So, I think that people are picking up on all that. I'm really, like, to tell you the honest truth, being a person who looks at what we would call life path potentials for planet Earth, the fact that we are still actually able to go put money in banks right now is really surprising to me.
Yeah.
Like, it's the feeling in the universe is almost like, okay, we are running on fumes at this point. Mm-hmm. When is it? You know? Yeah.
Absolutely. That's I'm also equally surprised that we've made it this far, but the number of tricks and levers and things that have been pulled to just deny that,
yep,
and keep it going just a little bit longer. But the problem is, and I think this is what I detect and what I talk about and people understand increasingly, is that the more we deny it, it's like we're having more drinks as an alcoholic, or we're going further up. We were three rungs up a stepladder, but now we're 12. So the fall, yep, from here is going to be hard. And I noticed when you did say the word collapse, you wrung your hands and a look of sadness came over you. I want to talk to that part because I feel my culture in particular doesn't do grief. Right. So when I say people feel unhappy, what I'm really detecting under there is a strong, repressed feeling of grief. So let me speak for myself. I feel grief when I read about what's happening to the oceans. I feel grief, yep, over the fact that I make a practice of stopping whenever I see a turtle and I get out of my car and I help it to the other side of the road. And I haven't stopped in 15 years because I haven't seen one. And I feel grief over that. And so that's really part of my motivation in doing the work I do, is to say, how do I reach people with this information? And I think a blocking point to that is there's grief down there. So first talk to the grief that we're experiencing, and then I want to get to the second part, which is how do we begin to surface it, if it's possible?
Well, the most critical aspect of going through any emotion is that you have to actually let yourself admit that it's there and to go through it. So getting people to admit that it's there is really about us getting so sick of our control strategies because they're not working anymore that we're kind of forced into it. Honestly, like if I found a way to convince people that they needed to go into their grief, I would have done that already, but I've never found a way. I've only ever seen it work that people basically run into a dead end in their own life with they're trying to escape from this emotion or trying to control it away, and then they go look for somebody that can help them get into the emotion. But it's that willingness that has to surface first in the person, and we can't really create it. So once a person's ready for that, then what we have to do is to actually admit to what we are losing, you know? But through that, after we let ourselves go through that, that also tells us what is wanted. This is the most important thing to understand about the way that this time-space reality that we're living in is designed. It's designed so that the unwanted gives rise to what is wanted. So, for example, going through all of what we did in World War II, there was more of a desire for peace delivered in mankind as a result of that particular war than at any other point in history. So a lot of the subsequent, let's say, peaceful social dynamics that came out of that were the result of that contrast. So what I would say to people who are really feeling, let's say, grief at what they're losing, is that the time after you have, of course, gone through the grief, the time has come to shift your focus to what you want to build instead. This is the issue with the human race, is that we continue to make the same mistake over and over and over again because we are unwilling to actually face the music. If we face the music, then we're going to learn from the mistake. We won't continue to build the same structure, which then collapses again. So our entire social structure is looking in the future to be completely different than it is. We're going to be oriented more towards support of each other. It's not going to be a competitive type of society. The way we raise children will be completely different. And something that we're not real present to yet is that if you raise children differently, with an entirely different attitude towards the way that they are, let's say, breastfed, the way they're brought into the world through birth, the way that we keep them in the first 3 months, the way that they initiate their own independence instead of us pushing them out there, the difference in the school systems, then you will raise an entirely different adult that looks at the world differently. So once we do that, you're literally not even going to recognize the way society works. Okay, so like right now, we'd say there's no way for us to support that amount of people. There is definitely a way, but you have to, you essentially have to create socialism. But the thing is, like, this is when I say that, people get really nervous, right?
Yeah.
We're like, oh my God, socialism. I'm like, yeah, but this is the thing. Socialism is genius. It works. Except it will never work as long as there is one person that doesn't want it. If you have one person that wants more power than another person, socialism will not work, and it will never work to enforce socialism. Basically, socialism that is enforced becomes communism, and there's nothing in between. And that's nobody, it doesn't benefit anyone because it's just restriction. But what we see when people's consciousness increases, when we realize what we would prefer instead for the world, is that people will sort of on their own accord will move into a socialist ideal, and then society will reflect that. You won't have people that are out of alignment so as to create, let's say, negative capitalism. This is why I tend to focus rather than like forcing social change, I tend to focus on transforming individuals. Mm-hmm. Because what we have to see is that a society is made up of individuals. So if we can get an individual to find a state of awakening or a state of enlightenment or a state of embracing their own emotion, then society will reflect the individual.
I totally agree. I'm going to skip ahead to a quote I have here because this has been my own path. I truly believe, like, I'm not out here trying to change the world. I'm not here trying to influence political systems. I'm not a top-down person. I'm helping people achieve resilience in their own lives. First, because if they have resilience in their lives, they can bring resilience to their families. If their family's resilient, they'll be in a position to help their neighbor. If their neighbors and them are all resilient, then you have a resilient town. If we have that, then we can have a resilient state, and on it goes. It can't be top-downed. But I have this quote from Carl Jung that I just love. And he said, "There is no coming to consciousness without pain. People will do anything, no matter how absurd, in order to avoid facing their own soul. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious." And so the questions here for me are, things seem pretty absurd right now. How much more absurd do they have to get before we're going to really face that darkness?
Pretty absurd.
Yeah.
What we're going to start seeing is what we have already started seeing, which is a giant polarization within the human race. We're going to see a whole huge demographic waking up and in higher numbers than ever before, and a whole huge demographic resisting more so than they ever have. So it's that splitting, essentially, which is, I guess, the necessary conditions. But for a lot of people, we have to understand the human ego to understand why it's so difficult for us to awaken. I mean, I can make it really quick. Do you want me to make it super quick for people? Because
yeah,
it'd probably be interesting.
Please do.
All right. When you're young, you're born essentially devoid of a separate sense of self. And you learn primarily about your sense of self through mirroring through people. So you act a certain way and your mom says, oh my gosh, and you learn about yourself because of that reflection. It's why kids who don't have that reflection from any adult figure, we would call this feral child syndrome, those types of kids have no self-concept because they've been completely devoid of reflection. So when we're socialized into society, we learn that certain things are acceptable and certain things aren't. Emotions, acceptable or unacceptable. Actions, acceptable or unacceptable. So everything goes into that acceptable, unacceptable. the subconscious is comprised of what we have been reflected as unacceptable and bad. We have to differentiate ourselves from that. We have to hide it essentially and create a facade. That's the human ego. We have to create a facade, which is an idea of self. That's all it is. It's how we look to the world. That is absolutely protected at all costs because we're a social species. What happens when mom or dad punishes you or puts you in time out, which is even worse for a lot of kids, is that we get taught that the risk of essentially exposing our true selves is to be abandoned or to be punished. So with those kind of consequences and severe consequences for a social species, because being separated from the social group meant death, that's just embedded in our DNA, essentially we would rather face death. We have to face death quite literally before we're willing to take that, let's say this is my acceptable idea of self, down and out of the way. So what we have to understand is the reason that Carl Jung is right about that particular statement, that there will be no coming into consciousness without pain, is because what created the subconscious to begin with was pain. It's the fact that I present myself and I just learned that all of myself is not okay. So I start suppressing it, rejecting it, denying it, disowning it. And so it's my own rejection of self that has created that. So you have to go back through that window that was created, back through all that self-rejection and that pain that originally happened through the creation of the ego, in order to break past the ego. But, I mean, obviously, if what matters to us more than anything in the world, I mean, entire wars are waged, by the way, so that we can keep our self-concept, essentially the ego deciding that it's right, that it's justified, and that it's good. If you look at, like, any of the warmongers, look at Stalin, look at Hitler, they all believed, and this was the ego, that they were right, that they were justified, that they were good. So it's almost like the ego's need to see itself that way will create any kind of pain it needs to on the world. So the scary part, which is the answer to your question, is how bad does it have to get? It has to get that bad for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It has to get to the degree where, I mean, my own enlightenment a long time ago was as a result of that. Sometimes you literally have to be looking at an entire field full of dead bodies for you to get out of the ego. That's the danger of the human ego. But I also don't want to, like, give the idea that the ego is all completely wrong. The ego was a design that would help us to enlighten. We cannot understand what we are unless we understand what we are not. So the only way that we would ever get enlightenment is if there is the existence of ego. We can't understand oneness unless we understand separateness, for example. So it doesn't work to go to war with the human ego either. Going to war with the human ego is doing nothing but fueling the fire for the ego. What we have to do is to love the ego into alignment. The ego is the byproduct of a small child that learned that it wasn't right or good or okay. Mm-hmm.
So in 2016, then, here's where I was wrong about a lot of things. So in 2008, I'd been calling for a large financial crisis for a while. It was very obvious. I'm a very public writer about all of those things. And then we got this close to a really serious breakdown. And that was a pretty good shot across the bow. And on the large sense, we were doing something that didn't make sense, right? We were borrowing at twice the rate that our economy was growing. And that doesn't make sense for an individual, doesn't make sense for a country. And instead of taking that moment to say, huh, that wasn't a good idea, we doubled down on the whole thing. We said, nuh-uh, we're going to keep this going. We printed more money. We got more people in student debt. The government's more in debt than ever before. We just did it again. And so that led me at this point here in 2016 to think, I think we're going to have a pretty hard fall in order to really confront, or culturally. I think individuals are waking up to this, but culturally I'm less sanguine than I used to be, that we're going to have anything other than a pretty hard path. Do you have any particular visions or ideas around what you see coming for the next few years?
Yeah.
You don't have to share them if they don't make sense, but.
Well, my struggle, I mean, it's more of an interesting thing for this conversation would be for me to expose the fact that, as somebody who very much so has their finger in prophecy and sees life path potentials for collective consciousness, not just individuals, it's very difficult for me to stand on stage at this point, mm-hmm, with complete confidence every time and to feel incredibly excited about what we're headed towards. And what I'm seeing is a conjunction. And with a conjunction of purification, then basically that spells not just economic collapse and not just interpersonal collapse, but also environmental collapse. I see like a basically the kind of calamity that religions have ironically been talking about for thousands of years. And now scientists are starting to think, wow, they might be completely accurate, even though there's not a sort of religious stint put on it. And I'm watching wars. I mean, for a while now, in fact, since about 2001, we've been a match and haven't changed off that path. We've been a match to a third world war. But at this particular day and age, with the weaponry that we're dealing with and the egos we're dealing with in charge of that weaponry, essentially, it means destruction. It means destruction, you know? Like, you can't just, there's no such thing as an isolated war in today's world, because everything is just a sequence of dominoes, one stacked on top of the other. So what I'm starting to do now, instead of educate people that they can pull out of it, is to put all of their focus on what is going to come after the fact. It's almost like that moment. Have you ever played the game Jenga? Mm-hmm. We're in a moment in the game where you know that we're at the point where the next one that gets pulled out is going to collapse the whole system. So if we have an attachment to it staying up at this point, we're going to really hurt. So a lot of my education would be to see the beauty in the whole system collapsing and try to figure out what we want to build in its wake, which is why I'm hoping that a lot of people start going that path now, where we're not trying to do anything with the current system that we have. We're not trying to recover. What we're trying to do is figure out, based on what we learned didn't work this time, what to do instead, so that there's kind of a safety net that catches the people from the fall. And in my world, a lot of that is going to revolve around community. The single family household and property ownership is what got us into this particular mess, if you'd like to know the honest truth. We used to operate in a tribal kind of setting. That had its own issues because we went to war with each other all the time. But the real problem is that the minute that we got attached to property ownership, we got real capitalistic, very like me, mine, and the ego got so incredibly fueled, essentially, that it started to be able to do things at the detriment of everything around it. It lost its connection with the rest of the world, which is, if you want to know the psychological issue that we've really got going that's led into this, it's that. With tribal societies that could not see themselves as separate from the world that it lived in, it could see that by over-hunting, for example, it was only killing itself. By creating the single family household and property ownership and making it all about me, basically, and being able to farm so we never feel the impact of the seasons or the world around us, essentially, we believed ourselves to be so outside of the system that we were no longer a part of the web. We're about to be dealt a very harsh card, which is, guess what, you're part of the web. And if the web decides you're not assisting it, you're going to be treated by the totality of the universe like a cancer cell. So for us, we need to get back in touch with those kinds of connections. It's one reason why right now I'm putting like a ton of my effort into intentional community, trying to bring people together, because we're headed towards a kind of world where we're going to be really dependent on each other. And I think it would be an interesting thing for, you know, even the people, you've got a lot of people who are really invested in that single family household ideal and like living within society, deep in society, not fringe dwellers, right? Mm-hmm. For that person, it's pretty easy to say, oh, I'm really an independent person. But independence is not possible. So my challenge would be, I mean, think about how many things you're dependent on today. Think about what you're dependent on if your internet goes out or if your grocery store doesn't exist anymore. You know, like, what would you do if X, Y, and Z fell? And this is a good way to see how dependent you are. And that then kind of inspires a person to lend their energy back to these things that they are dependent on. So I feel like it's going to be a lot of the self-sustainable communities that do well in this particular collapse, the people who get together and they actually have a way of growing their own food, for example, and everybody's lending their energy to a piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is touching in our work at Peak Prosperity. We, you know, you look out my window, there's a garden, there's chickens, there's an orchard, and we do have a lot of people who are going down the self-sufficiency path, but we don't take the survivalist, we don't take the prepper mentality, because you're only as safe as your neighbor anyway, as it turns out.
Well, I mean, I really, yeah, okay, so basically the survivalist attitude is going to do nothing in a law of attraction universe except for attract the very thing that they're afraid of. But my absolute favorite thing to do is to call people on it, because so many people who are in that survivalist mentality, they've got this image of, like, zombie apocalypse. So what they've got in their mind of wartime is essentially bad guys that are banging your door down, and it's easy to shoot them. But what they really have to realize is it's like, it's not going to be those types of people on your doorstep. It's going to be a kid, you know, a person with six kids who are all starving to death. So are you prepared to shoot them or turn them away and say you can't have, nobody's prepared to do that. So yeah, we're not, it's not that survivalist mentality is never going to work.
Right, right. So let's talk community. You said a very important word, and something that we increasingly are focusing on ourselves in my life, but also in my larger professional life, is how to really build that community. Because one of my projections about my culture, very isolationist, you know, we've got these wonderful smartphones, I've got one, and they're very good at creating the appearance of connection, but not really. And yep. And I was really turned when I saw this TED talk on addiction. And, yep. And really the addiction is just a measure of the degree of personal isolation somebody's experiencing. Addiction is really a symptom 100%. Of lack of connection. So
100%.
How do we go about begin making it okay to be vulnerable and to begin to step out of our shells, as it were? Because I was born, raised, and bred to have a single family household, right? I know exactly how to do that. Building community, a little messier, a little harder, more human. How do you advise people to go about beginning that messy process?
Well, first you got to be willing to feel. So all of it starts from that base, like absolutely everything. And if we're unwilling to take a step, it's because we think taking that step is going to feel bad. Everything boils down to how we feel. So if we become willing to feel emotion to begin with, then we're going to be more likely to not be inhibited by those emotions. So say fear, for example. If it's not okay to feel fear, then you're going to avoid everything that causes you to feel fear. But if you become okay with feeling fear, you change what it means to you, essentially, then you're going to probably take a step that enables you to do something regardless of the fact that fear is present. That's the real difference between any kind of success and real failure, is just the willingness to feel. Now, what we have to understand is that people are essentially imprisoned in this position where they've been taught, same as that part of that ego forming, it's part of that socialization process, we've been taught that certain emotions are okay and certain emotions are not okay. So the second that you feel an emotion that's not okay, you're going to instantly go into control mode about it. You're going to basically do anything you can to either escape from it or to control it away. But that actually is like adding fuel to the fire. So what we have to get is that suffering, genuine suffering, which is what we're really afraid of, is not actually the result of experiencing pain. It's the result of us resisting experiencing pain. Hmm. We've made it not okay. So, and like, this is the best thing you can ever tell somebody who has anxiety, by the way. And so it's good we're having this conversation right now, because what is the number one emotion that comes up as a result of all of this imminent doom, essentially, within society, is anxiety. Mm-hmm. Anxiety, if you think, oh my gosh, it's not okay, why am I feeling this way, it's not okay to feel this way, something must be wrong with me, those types of thoughts, as a result of feeling anxiety, it is like a rash. You might as well just go with kerosene on top of a fire, you know? So if you could talk to yourself in a way where you're saying, you know what, these are just at the end of the day sensations. It's an uncomfortable sensation, but it doesn't mean anything about me. It doesn't mean that anything wrong is happening. It doesn't mean that I'm messed up. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be there. It just is there. Then we will have that willingness. Second step is to realize that we're living in the world where intentional community doesn't have to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's really important for people too, because I mean, it's easy to listen to, you know, spiritual teachers like me and think, oh, she's just trying to turn everyone into a hippie commune. No, like, I feel like intentional community is going to look totally drastically different for this group than it does for this group. Mm-hmm. Like, let's pretend even if you're in medical school, for example. Let's pretend we get a whole group of people that are all in medical school. And what's really challenging is doing medical school and getting everything else done at the same time. So if we could get all of these people together in a kind of community living setting, then they could all support each other in that process. So if one person doesn't have something to do this day, they're cooking for the house. And then, you know, for example, so somebody who has maybe a test that lasts till 10 p.m. at night comes home, and then there's food there. Oh my gosh, I feel so much more supported. And then they can, of course, fuel each other with that emotional support if I know exactly what it's like to be going through this type of a thing. That's just one example. So, I mean, intentional community doesn't have to look a certain way. And this is what I think is so beautiful about what's happening in countries like Denmark right now, is that they're basically creating these apartments, and they're doing fabulously well with them. They're mainstream apartments. These are not hippie at all. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's a huge apartment building, but there's a common area and a common kitchen. And everybody like lends their support, almost like a family or a tribe would, to the collective child rearing, to the food that's created there. And they're all kind of shifting around in the supportive type of way. But it doesn't look hippie. People still have jobs. They still have families. But they also have this social support. So I feel like that's a really beautiful bridge for getting us out of the single family household, so that we have more support, so that you can collapse without losing your entire life. You know? Mm-hmm. But also not taking people so far outside the box that they're like, oh my God, you know.
too far, too fast. Well, so you're really saying it begins with a personal transformation first. I mean, there's an element of looking at our own isolated lives and saying, not ideal or can be improved upon. There's lots of ways to do that. But it really begins with ourselves and that first willingness to be uncomfortable. And I guess what I hear... Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is that it always starts with the individual, but either we're going to consciously make the decision to do it or we will be forced to do it. It's the same process. It's going to be an individual process, whether or not we do this before a collapse or whether all of society collapses and we're in a position where we're like, oh, now I have to face all of this stuff. So my wish would be that people would say, okay, I can feel this kind of percolating. So let's think about in my life right now, right here with me, what kind of changes I can make to invest my energies in a kind of society which I feel like is actually sustainable.
Well, that's the goal. Of course, you know, a lot of what we have today is very unsustainable, and we know this. And
Do we? Because that's the thing. Like, I keep getting this message from the collective, which is almost like there's an unwillingness to actually look at the fact that it's unsustainable.
Well, there's something that could be sustainable. So in my work, I get to go to places like Singing Frogs Farm out in Sebastopol, California, where they've now created 4 feet of topsoil. They're making $100,000 per acre. They grow year-round when everybody else can only do 2, maybe 3 seasons. Like, so it's clearly possible. Or Polyface Farm in Virginia. We can do things regeneratively and relationally, but we're still doing them extractively and transactionally, right? And so Go.
I mean, I'm just interested in your opinion as to why you think we're still doing it this way when we know that these things exist. This has been, I mean, I'm just interested to hear your perspective too. I've got my own perspective also, but it's like what I watch over and over again is we've got these genius ideas, we've got free energy, we've got all of these things. So why have they not been adopted yet?
Well, you know, in my business, I thought I was in the information sharing business for a long time. I have this book and this video series called The Crash Course. It lays out all the data. And I did that for years with my wife watching audiences as I gave these talks. And I'm a slow learner. So about 5 years into that process, I realized I'm not in the information business. Information works for me, you know, the way my brain is wired. It turns out I'm a very small minority. And I realized I was in the belief challenging business. So I had to do this whole detour into understanding psychology and behavioral economics and all the science that underlies why people actually make decisions based on their emotions. The amygdala is ruling this show, right? So
everything.
Then I had to recraft everything and structure my whole talk so that I went from little beliefs to the hardest, you know, so that I gained currency along the way. And that was ultimately my path to learning how to effectively communicate. But information doesn't do it. So we have all of these really, we knew how to build zero energy homes in the 1970s. We've known how to farm regeneratively in a way that actually has more, it's better for everything, right? We could put solar thermal panels on our roofs, which makes environmental sense, local jobs, economic sense, you name it, and we don't do it. So we don't do it for reasons. We do it for beliefs. So really my ultimate question to you is, I'm always trying to, and I don't have the answer, so I'm always digging, is how do we most effectively communicate in ways that shift beliefs?
You have to appeal to people's needs. Right now, I think a big issue that we have, and it is, honestly, I'd love to tell you that it was just purely accidental, but it wasn't. A lot of the corporations that wanted to make the kind of money they wanted to make made it complicated enough that we would have to do what we've done. But basically, right now, we have got to make things so easy for people because they feel so overwhelmed. Overwhelm is the most common, especially in the Western world, is the most common emotion. So every action that will be taken to escape from overwhelmment. So it takes somebody who's got usually a serious crisis with their own conscience to force them to take the effort and add to their feeling of overwhelm to go figure out how to put solar panels on their house. So the reality is that for those of us that are in this kind of business, I hope somebody's watching that is right now, we have got to make it so damn easy and available that it does not add to people's overwhelmment for them to adopt change. And the companies that have done really well slash screwed the world have done that. They have made things so convenient that it has decreased people's sense of overwhelmment. Financially, time management-wise, everything.
Well, now we're sort of at a loggerheads because the whole idea of beginning the personal journey begins with something that most people would experience in, I hate to use these terms, but a painful or hard or something like that. I now use in my own life the word intense. It's just, I like intensity now.
That's true, but there's an interesting little caveat here. I see a lot of people who are real wealthy who are really interested in this stuff. Why? Because they have time on their hands. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if people weren't completely overwhelmed all day long, every single day, it's like you can go two ways. Either having nothing to focus on leads you towards the questioning of the universe and then breaks you out of the box, or being so overwhelmed that everything collapses breaks you out of the box. So either we wait for people to basically hit their crisis point and have an existential crisis to wake up, or else we make it so easy on them, essentially, make life so easy that they start asking those questions in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, speaking personally again, you know, this was, I had a pretty tough introduction to, I had my own personal crisis, and then, but from that, I am now happier, healthier, wealthier, more connected, more alive than I've ever been. So I actually look back at that moment of crisis in my life and I say, thank you. And I wish it had come earlier. I wish that had happened decades before, but I'm glad it happened when it did. So there we go. It happened when it needed to. So part of the thing I struggle communicating to people is, yes, there's this hero's journey you might embark on, but it's so worth it, right? It's really... It's so worth it, but it's also so essential because when you look at the data, if you really allow it to come in, you say, we have to do things differently. But not we, it's I have to do things differently. So that's the part I still struggle with because I drive a car and I've got a warm house and I have other things that, you know, people in the world don't have, which I have to begin really looking at in my own way, right? So you're laughing at that.
No, what I'm laughing at is just, well, I mean, what we're talking about is a spiritual rebirth of self. Mm-hmm. It's a birth process. And if you've ever watched a woman who's in the throes of labor, like no amount of, oh, this is going to be worth it, is going to work for her. So it's, I mean, even though we wish we had that voice coming in when we're in the middle of the existential crisis being like, it's all going to be so worth it in the end. It's just, it's almost like empty words at that point, which is why I feel like even though that's completely true, when we're in the middle of it, I think what we need most is somebody who's saying, you know what, I'm right here with you. We can go into this. It's okay that you're in pain right now. This is going to kill you type of energy. Because like what we see with women in labor, and we can apply this completely to this existential crisis, you know, the spiritual self rebirth, is that when a woman's in the middle of transition, which is the worst phase of labor, essentially the women that do the best with that are the ones that surrender to it. It's the women who say, oh my God, this is so much pain, I can't deal with this, feel that kind of resistance to it. They're the ones that get put in the real hurt locker and they can hardly make it through and often end up getting epidurals if there's epidurals available. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we can learn a lot from that. If we completely surrender to the process, then we're not going to be in as much pain. But that means being willing to feel pain. So this, of course, we come back to this theme, which keeps coming up in this particular interview, which is that we have to really be willing to feel things. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank and you are... for that. Yeah, is there more?
Well, I mean, and are we? I mean, we got to ask ourselves a question. Are we willing to feel something? Mm-hmm. Most of everything we do during the day, even people in the self-help, in the spiritual business, we're kind of culprits as well. Most of what we do all day long is just trying to control our emotion. Why do you go on a walk to feel better? Why wasn't it okay to feel bad?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, then I have a personal question for you because of my particular spot in life. Maybe you've got some insight for me is on the idea of authentic leadership. So I'm in the business of challenging people's beliefs, and they don't always appreciate that. And so slings and arrows and all sorts of things, and I'm sure you've received your share of all of that. And the balance I struggle with is personal transparency and privacy.
Oh, my God.
And I'm wondering what you've got to say on that subject.
When you're in the middle of being transparent and it comes back to bite you because they use it against you, it is very, very, very freaking hard to stay transparent. Mm-hmm. But to tell you the honest truth, coming from my absolute highest space, transparency is the only thing that's going to transform this world. And what do we see with revolution over and over again over the course of history is that it takes one person who is willing to do it first. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to be treated well. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like it's like the person who ends up standing up for racial equality. They're going to have those arrows slung at them. But 20 years down the road, they're going to be exalted. Rosa Parks was an outrage, and now she's a hero. Because we see essentially what is right and what's in alignment with creating a world that we would rather be living in. Transparency and openness is what's going to create a world that is not completely run by ego. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's going to take those of us who really feel that that's the way to go to be brave enough to do it no matter what the cost is. And we have to keep our eye. This is not about martyrdom. It's about keeping our eye on the vision we want to create. Mm-hmm. So picture that world like that would be so amazing that no pretense existed. If you picture that world or whatever that world of, I mean, you can tell me what the world that is the byproduct of transparency would look like to you, but that has to be 100% what you hang on to, regardless of what gets thrown at you. And it's almost like you make it bigger than you. And I mean, to a certain degree, there are aspects of your spiritual practice which it's really beneficial to be super self-centered about it and self-reflective about it. But this is one of those cases where I feel like it's really important to bring in the greater vision for the collective of humanity with it and make it bigger than you. I mean, for those of us who like, back during the whole racial inequality phase, we had to make that bigger than us to be okay with the amount of backlash we were receiving. So we have to make it bigger than us if we're willing to be transparent. Mm-hmm. And there are some of us that are doing it.
Uh-huh. Well, it's I've been called everything in the book. I think, you know, Malthusian, Cassandra, all of this. And it's just data, you know, but there's times it's hard. There's some days I wake up saying, "Why didn't I think to sell pet rocks? That sounds so much happier and easier," you know.
Oh, I wish it would be good for you. We should maybe video ourselves and then send it to each other to make us feel better. I have days like that all the time where I'm like, gosh, should have just been a housewife. Like something else.
Well, blessings on that part of your journey. It's something, but I feel as we get closer and closer to the denouement of this show that you're right, that polarization is getting very extreme. I can feel it widening. The emotions are going to be really up and center to the point that people just can't ignore them anymore. It's already pretty clearly out and evident at this point. And I don't see how it gets better until it gets worse, if we want to use that language, because we're still not really facing up to the core pieces at this point. All the Yep. conditions that have ever been in place for revolutions in the past are here. The elites lose touch with the people. They say, let them eat cake, you know?
Yep.
And the people go, yeah, that's kind of annoying. So, you know, that's a big part of where I see where we are in this story right now is a lot of denial. And that's going to, it's going to have something to teach us, certainly. In the last question, so your latest book is Shadows Before Dawn, Finding the Light of Self-Love Through Your Darkest Times. Sounds like an appropriate title for this. why did you write that book?
Well, basically, I was giving this conversation. I was having a conversation actually over the radio, and I was talking about how everything boils down to self-love. But I really, even the word self-love, it makes me cringe too. So just so you know, if anybody's watching this interview and I say self-love and you feel everything in your body, just your fibers be like, ugh, you know, I actually get that same reaction to self-love. So it's basically a trite self-help sort of cute spiritual, let's call it a whitewash. Mm-hmm. What I really realized going through all the hell that I went through is that I was in such resistance to myself that was what was really doing the majority of the damage. And so I was talking about how everything boils down to your relationship with yourself and really how to practically develop a relationship with yourself so you can wake up and actually want to be in your own skin every day. And I thought, my God, wait a minute. Here I am saying that everything boils down to self-love. Like, why the hell haven't I written that book yet? And what was really pissing me off is that everybody and their mothers, when you go to see them for help, says, you know what? You just got to learn how to love yourself. And you're like, thank you. I don't know what that means. Like, how do I practically do that? And nobody can answer that question. So I embarked on this quest to basically figure out how to do that. And I have a mind that works a lot like you. I'm an information person too. So it's about like looking in as an observational thing. Looking at the people who really do love themselves and put themselves first. What are they doing differently? What's the variable there that's making them that way as opposed to other people in society that aren't, that are going to jobs they can't stand? The people who are self-hating to the point where they've got addictions and are injuring. Like, what is the difference? Because if I could figure out that difference, I could figure out how to teach this person to come bridge this gap over to being the kind of person that values themselves. And so that book essentially was a how-to, practically how to do it.
So would that be suitable for somebody who, I get this a lot in the seminars I give, people will say, I feel like I'm leading two lives. You know, the one I'm leading and the one I'm supposed to be leading. Would this be an appropriate book for that person?
Yeah, it'd be a super good one. But like, I'm watching this more and more. This is the inauthenticity. And right now, when we're in the time of purification, essentially, purification means the human ego disappears. Fear is what fuels the human ego, fear and pain. So fear is essentially what's causing this double life. It's basically that there is a difference between the real me and what I think is right. So we have to be brave enough, if we're going to embark on this particular path, to be willing to say what's real instead of what we think is right or justified or okay or good. Mm-hmm. And until we're willing to admit to that, we can't work with anything real. It's like, I mean, for example, I just did a video on racism. It got more blowback than almost any other video. People were livid. Because in that video, I made the statement that there's not a single person that's not racist. Not one. If you have a different reaction when you walk down the street to somebody who's a different color than you, then that's a form of racism. And so because we have made that now in today's world, we've made it so not okay, we can't admit to what's real about ourselves. But until we admit to that, we can't work with it. So it's like there's absolutely no improvement you can make to a person who says, no, I'm not racist, no matter what. Nope, that's not me. That may be you, but it's not me. That level of defense, you can do nothing with it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes what we have to be willing to do is to say what's real, even if it doesn't sound good. And it's all fear on the other side of that. It's if I admit to this thing that's real about me, like, look what's going to happen to me. But unless some of us are, I mean, this is part of why you feel so called to do that, you know, that authenticity thing, that transparency thing. Unless some of us actually lead the march and say, look, this is what's real about me, no one's going to follow suit. And if we have a whole world that follows suit, we can't make an enemy of certain things anymore because it's too diffused. For example, moms are never supposed to admit to how hard it is to have kids and how it sucks sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes as a mother, you're just like, why the hell did I do this? You know? Mm-hmm. And because we're not willing to admit it, we get into, you know, we go to parties together and we all say, oh my God, it's lovely. It's just wonderful. I'm doing this. Let me show you how good I'm doing with my kid. We can't admit to what's real. Then we can never actually make improvements to the way that we mother or the way that we involve other people in our parenting. So really the shift in society is going to be the result of us all being like, yeah, this is what's real. And I mean, think about what we could do with that. If you just had a whole group of women, imagine just the transformation of just that one thing, like a whole group of women who are all like, yeah, it sucks sometimes. Imagine the amount of weight that comes off. And then it can be about, oh, how do we actually make it better instead of pretending it's okay. But I mean, I realize that was a little bit of a tangent, but what you're basically saying is what I am seeing all the time, is that like people in general have to live the mask, and then there's what's real behind it, but often we don't even know what's there until there's a crisis, and then it's like, you know.
And then it all comes crashing down.
Yeah.
And we're in the tunnel for a while, and hopefully somebody's there helping us in that process. And that's I think why I was so afraid for so long to have any sort of a crisis in my own self, because I'd created that mask. I had a full armored system around it, and so I knew intuitively I had no support system that I could really count on, right? Who was I going to talk to about this? So it took a lot of reforming for me to get through that, and it was a process. But again, for anybody listening, so worthwhile.
I mean, gosh, can you remember the pressure? Like, I remember that. The days where I'm getting slaughtered publicly.
Yep.
I have that moment where I remind myself, do you remember what it was like? Just the amount of pressure every day going out there and not being able to say what's real about yourself. It's actually a relief, even though it's kind of scary. It's also a relief to have everybody know what's going on with me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Well, absolutely. And I'm a few steps behind you on that, but I'm getting there. And so I really wanted to thank you for your time here and also your guidance in the past. I've watched a lot of your videos as well, attended one of your seminars in New York City a while back, and that was very illuminating, and it was fun to watch how you work with people. And I do want to help direct people to your book, which is Shadows Before Dawn, and also to, you've got a website and maybe some other appearances coming up. So how could people find out more about you and follow you?
My website is www.teelswan.com. And so you can follow me there. I'm also on all the social networks. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. And then I've also got a weekly YouTube video that comes out on YouTube. So most of the people who like to stay tapped into the information coming through me like to go on there. Because every Saturday there's a new video on a new subject and no one knows what it's going to be. So it's super fun.
All right. Any presentations coming up or anything like that for people?
Yeah, I have a crap ton. That's why it's probably – because I don't actually keep track of my own schedule.
Totally understand.
But like, good. I know that I'm going to be in Orlando, actually, in a week and a half. Yeah. And then after that, I'm going on a European tour. So those are the two that I know for a fact I'm doing.
All right. Very good. People can find that on your website, I'm sure. So, Teal, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for your work, and mostly for your authentic leadership. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.